Tarma Hadaven.
Him and Koval.
Yo.
How are my levels?
Always on point. Yo, but there's levels to this. So, you know, you sound good.
Thank you.
And fresh blues jersey back from
not
the
really
loo.
Fresh. I need to get it dry clean.
That looks good, though.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Children's jersey, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. Listen.
Wayne Gretzky.
Yo, I want to remind folks that we do have a new handle on the Interconnected Networks. We're going to re-record our outro, by the way.
At some point.
No, I think today. Oh, I think today's okay. The day. But
yeah,
but
we could do that.
Yeah, for those who, please, holler at us. Tell us what you like. We got some great feedback on our last episode. Some folks were saying it was like one of their favorites. Molly Gloss was dropping a lot of tips about, how to use the makeups. But our Interconnected Network handle on the gram and also Twitter is at Cornerstore_pod.
Yes, on everything.
On everything. Okay, yeah. Cool. I'm excited about this this day.
It is an exciting day.
It is. Yeah, we got a great guest. I'm going to. Recently, our guest asked me to write something for a publication they have coming out later in the year, and so I just want to read a little, if that's okay, about what I wrote about this our guest's aesthetics and art. I said legibility and humor, visible and highly readable, a crudeness, a frankness, a matter-of-fact Chicago style, unabashed tribute to the working class, an art you don't need a motherfucking MFA to appreciate or see, a Midwest Democratic portraitist of tamale men and Vienna hot dog vendors, everyday people, a Studs Terkel of street art, but he is also not a descendant of the hilarity and absurdity of the Chicago Imagist, a comic book Jim Nuthouse commenter on the condition of a changing dumb city, scribbling love notes in its nooks and crevices, an altar for its altered canvas, a champion of its people just trying to get by. And I think, for me, I've been checking out our guest's work on the streets for some time in the city. So excited to have him in the corner store. I guess make some noise, y'all, for Don't Fret. Or go silent. Thanks, Tara. All right, very good. Yo, man, welcome.
Yeah,
thanks,
welcome.
Man. Yeah, actually, it was cool to hear you read that because... I mean, I've read it several times, but I was so appreciative of you writing that piece at the Zero Hour. But
what's the publication for?
Making my first. Well, I made a couple books, but this is like my first monograph, so it's basically gonna be like everything I've done in the last 10 years, basically in a book.
Oh, word.
Like a retrospective, which is
really
amazing.
Yeah, it's like my first retrospective, which will be fun. But I'm stoked to hear you read that piece because I was so interested in your like is canter the right word? Like,
yeah,
like your
cadence.
Cadence, yeah.
Oh, cadence. Okay, because canter is also like a someone who sings in the synagogue, which I was like, word, yeah, I have a cantorial vibrato about me.
How horses gallop, but that's yeah. I think that's not the word.
That's I think that is also the word.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. Look, multiple definitions.
That's what's up.
The cadence.
Yeah, to hear you actually read it is pretty cool.
Well, I was honored to ask to write it, and I'm a real fan of the work. We're excited to hop in before we go anywhere.
Yes, of course.
We do have some snacks for you in the corner store. So, I really did think about bringing you like an old style, but I didn't. but just out the gate. I did bring you a an extra dry ginger ale.
Oh,
one, it's kind of delicious. Also, I feel like you are very funny in your pieces a lot of times, but I think it's humor.
Like a dry humor.
It is.
There's
an extra
less sugar.
See,
there's
less sugar.
Less sugar.
Boom.
See? I appreciate.
You got to watch your sugars.
There's some sugar.
Yeah. No. You got to watch your sugars.
How much sugar is there?
I also.
There's still 22 grams of sugar.
How is that less sugars?
Well, let's see. Hold on. Let's see if the mic will get the. Less carbonation too.
I know.
Oh, yeah.
But I do like the first sip.
Once it hits your lips,
you really like ginger ale.
Also, some.
I also appreciate that they used It's grown up soda, aka Gus. Yeah. So they antonyms the shit. Where did you get this?
That's great. You got it at Walgreens.
Yeah, I did get it at Walgreens.
What?
It's a fancy Walgreens near
what
the
fancy?
Trip.
It is.
Yeah.
What fancy?
Yeah, this is a fancy Walgreens. I also got you some Deep River snacks, but they're New York spicy dill pickle kettle chips.
All right.
Tight. And then. This is, you know, this is straight from our aspirational sponsor, someone yes. who we hope
have
in the future.
Have you spoken to my uncle? Because this is basically Christmas at my house. I just get...
We talked, I did some research prior, and he said these are the things you like. We have an RX bar for you, the chocolate chip brand, 3 egg whites, 6 almonds, 4 cashews, 2 dates, and no BS.
Didn't they just sell for like $6 billion or
shit,
something?
Really? They couldn't give us any of that bread?
Yeah, what's up with
is
that?
Is it still Chicago-based or owned? Or?
Yeah. Probably not.
Probably not.
Everything's bought by Amazon.
I mean, listen. So I do shop at Amazon.
6 whole almonds. What is this, like $5?
No, actually, they were running a sale. And that's our aspirational sponsor, man. You know,
yeah,
soon
you really
they're going to be.
Yeah,
exactly,
sponsors.
Exactly. Soon.
Except y'all can give us bread and I can put a price on that.
Yeah, exactly. We could talk to you about what it actually costs.
Right. It's not even now. It's not. And now we're sponsored by. It's we aspire to be sponsored by.
Yeah.
Well, we're about to throw some like fake commercials at.
Yeah,
at
exactly.
Our
yeah, yeah. We got some ideas. Yeah.
Are you?
Well, my first solo show ever was at Maxwell Collette Gallery.
Oh yeah.
And I built this whole like marketplace. I lived in Brazil for a while and I was really inspired by Brazil, so I built this sort of street marketplace, and there was a like when I was there during Carnival, all of these street vendors are just selling, you know, at whatever, whether it's food or booze or, you know, whatever. But they were always playing music. And so I made a recording. A buddy of mine had a studio at the time, and I made a recording that I played on a loop of all of these fake radio commercials. And it was just like, I don't even remember, but it was like, come on down to Uncle James Discount Auto Emporium at the corner of 79th and Cicero.
That's right. Yeah. We're going to need you.
We take those savings and we don't pass them on to you. Like,
look, at the end of this, we're going to get you to record a fake corner store commercial.
All right.
If you would.
Honestly, like, getting,
like a drop.
Getting our guests to do that.
I know. It's a good idea.
Yeah.
I like that idea.
Molly with the jingles.
I will happily start this.
This new
this
tradition.
Endeavor,
yeah,
yes.
But okay, cool. Thank you. Very generous. What a generous guy.
Yeah.
Well, yo, man, you're a visual artist. First saw your work on the street, have since seen it in not only the gallery space, but actually all over the city, now at this point, all over the world, in a variety of ways, wheat paste on the wall, on canvas, both large and small. You're from Chicago.
Born and raised.
Yeah, I mean, because in your work, you also put on for the city so heavy, you know, which is terrific to see. It's great to see. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Wicker Park. Born and raised.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh yeah, I read an article where it says you still live there.
I do.
What do you think of Wicker Park present day?
I mean, conflicted, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
I'm proud of my parents. I'm super proud of my parents for sticking it out. I mean, Wicker, it's almost comical to like talk about it in present day, but I mean, I have very vivid memories as a child of just understanding, basically until being a teenager, that like you live in the ghetto. Like you live in a bad neighborhood. Like I remember, I have a very vivid memory. One of my first friends, I made a friend at the park, and I like brought him back to my house, and we were playing basketball in my backyard, which was like 4 feet by 5 feet. And my mom's like, get in the house. Shit.
We could edit that out.
Yeah,
of course. We can edit that out. No, it's fine. Yeah, and just pick up. No. Please don't worry. And anything. Anything, yeah.
Complete sentences.
Yeah, no worries.
So anyway, so I made a friend at the park, and I like brought him back to my house, and we were playing basketball in the backyard, which was like 4 by 5 feet, and my mom was like, get in the house, And I was like, what's going on? You know, I made a friend. And she's like, you're never seeing that boy again. And I was like, why? And she's like, his dad is a Latin king. And like, and that was like, that was sort of the way it was. I mean,
and people just had that knowledge, though.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the neighborhood was very different, and it was like oddly sort of lonely growing up in a really big city. And and then around the early, I mean, I know there are chapters to this. I mean, I know now in hindsight, because of research I've done, that even in the mid 90s, Wicker was rapidly changing. But
yeah,
for me, it was like, I think it was like 2000. I think I started high school in 2002, and that was when it was like, boom, like, you got a bank, and you got Urban Outfitters, and you got this and this and this and this. And then,
well, that
was
the beginning of that new chapter. Like, 2001 is when, you know, I really began to see those kind of like where you began to see the neighborhood move into where it is now.
Yeah.
And so that, and it started to flip very quickly, where, you know, every week or so you'd be like, what is this here now? You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. You know, I remember, and I talked about this in other things, like, you know, as a kid, I remember getting off the school bus in second, third grade and, like, having to ask the old, like, Puerto Rican drunks to, like, get off my stoop so, you know, I could, like, get me and my little sister home. And, you know, these days it's, like, the same thing, except it's midnight and it's, like, some prick from Schaumburg, and I'm like, I don't know which one is better or worse,
right?
Obviously there probably isn't a correct answer.
Yeah Well, that's interesting. So what did your folks do, or what do they do?
So they were both artists. My mom actually worked for Rona Hoffman for a long time, and is a very talented painter herself. My dad was a professional photographer for a long time, and just kind of, he's lived a few lives. He was a cook, he was a photographer, now he's a contractor. And you know, I came from definitely a creative family. My parents bought an old brownstone that was previously abandoned and rehabbed the entire thing themselves, and my dad learned a lot of skills through that. And then I think he liked it more than he liked photography, especially when the digital revolution happened.
Yeah,
I think he was just kind of ready.
Yeah, maybe ready. He's tactile in that way.
Like,
yeah, he's very
transition though.
Yeah, I think he's a very
right. You said tactile. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, tactile or like industrial. You know, he likes.
Yeah, because photography prior to that point was that in some ways, right? It was a lot of like
developing photos.
Yeah, I mean,
we still have.
I mean, I still have a lot of really cool stuff. And actually, I studied photography in college.
Nice.
Yeah, we still have like an 8x10 Deerdorf.
Oh, wow.
Made in Chicago. Like, it's pretty cool.
Did they have studio space in the house when you were younger?
Yeah.
So they were, because that's interesting that you got to
see. I mean,
we
did the Jeffersons thing, man. It was. We were living on the first floor while they fixed the second floor. Then we were living on the second floor while we fixed the third floor. And then
just kept moving around. Nice.
Yeah.
So you consumed a lot of art growing up? Anything besides? Well, your mom was a painter.
Yeah. I mean, they were. I don't want to say that they pushed art on me.
We're artists. You have to be, okay?
You have to make
something. I mean, they were very
of yourself in this form.
I mean, they were extremely supportive. I mean, I painted from a very early age, and I remember even, I mean, there's like family videos of like me basically doing exactly what I'm doing now, which was just like, you know, my mom would tape up like 12 feet of paper and I would just draw the whole thing.
Wow.
There's a few that still exist, actually.
Yeah.
Any likeness?
Pretty crazy. And they're not too dissimilar.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
From what you do now.
Yeah. Yeah. They're very, I think even at 5 years old, I was on this trajectory, but I think
that's crazy.
Also that your folks, I mean, that's also beautiful, right? I mean, I don't know, you know, Atar, we've talked about this, but I find it's also a rare and very pleasant thing when you get to hear the parents are supportive of their kids.
I'm always surprised,
creativity.
Even if I feel like I hear it often
well,
enough. Well,
you know, there's definitely been some ups and downs.
Well, so. And also I wonder about like the ways that you've chosen to practice in some ways, which we'll get to. But
also,
right?
Yeah, like the hardships, like what were your parents? I mean, did they? I don't even know how to. I mean, what were the ups and downs? I guess you know, like. I guess it's more obvious for somebody whose parents aren't supportive.
Yeah, don't fuck with it from the beginning.
Right, that, well, that's I like think the biggest.
They're like, you're not going to be a journalist. I'm sorry.
Yeah, like,
you wildin'.
Yeah.
Well, what, I guess. I don't know how to describe it. I guess at various points in my life, I think I've really tried to please both of them and then had some success and some failure and was just like, hey, actually, I'm just going to do this for myself. I think they were very wary of raising an artist. I think, you know, they had both had success, but had both had a lot of failure. And, you know, when I, my college path was pretty straightforward. I played soccer my entire life. And I was offered a scholarship to play in college, and I turned it down because I was also in a band at the time, and I wanted to be in Chicago. I didn't want to be in bumfuck Iowa. And so basically I applied to art schools, and I think that they basically were like, we'll support you, but we're scared. You know?
Yeah.
And like it was very...
It's a lot to turn down, too.
Yeah, and it was, you know, I mean, I remember they took me to SIU, and they were like, if you go here, you'll graduate debt-free. And I was like, fuck this. Like, like there's not a chance in hell that I'm spending the next 4 years of my life in this godforsaken hellhole.
Wait, SIU is in...
Southern Illinois and Edwardsville or Carbondale.
Yeah,
or
somewhere.
Yeah, there's a few. Yeah. It is near St. Louis. Yeah.
Also,
right.
It has the highest STD rate amongst colleges in the country. So
really?
Probably would have left with like...
Good thing I never got
a communications degree in gonorrhea or something.
Woo. Yeah, yeah, with a minor in gonorrhea.
Okay, I'm,
but, I'm sorry. All right. Well, all right.
Anyways,
so,
but yeah, it was just well, you know. So, I mean, they were and are very supportive, but it was
that's interesting.
It was something
that's like typical.
I mean,
parenthood.
You can't explain this to an 18-year-old. You
yeah.
know, it was
you
like
can't explain shit. To
it
an
was like
really.
I
especially artists.
I sort of hate you guys. I love you, but I want to get the fuck out of here. And you're telling me that for the first time in my life, there's this magical place where, like, I can do exactly what I want to do, and there are girls that are going to respect me for it, and, like, people that will respect me for it, and I've only made, like, $500 in my entire life, so $40,000 is this, like, arbitrary, ridiculous
right.
number that doesn't exist in reality,
it's
and I'm just
imaginary.
Like, yeah, that's not real, just sign the paper, you know, get the fuck out, get me the fuck out of here.
They're like, yo, $40,000
also,
is mad
cafeteria
real.
Food's pretty good, so, like, let's just,
that's all that matters.
Let's get
real.
The hell out of here.
Well, that's just interesting, though, that that's just, like, typical parent shit, even though they're artists, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
So before you get to that point, you, because I'm curious, so you went to high school in Chicago.
Yeah.
You went where?
I went to Peyton.
Okay, so growing up in Wicker, though, and going to Peyton certainly seems interesting, and the culture of Peyton.
Well, so, not to, sorry.
Please, go to no, do it.
But the side note and caveat is I went to elementary school in Little Italy.
Ah.
Mm. So even though, so... I actually think it's one of the best gifts that was ever given to me in my life is, you know, these days in 2018, it's very easy, I think, to tuck point this like, oh, you know, white kid from Wicker Park that had a great education. But Little Italy, you know, basically I grew up in a neighborhood at that time. It was, you were Polish or Puerto Rican, and I was neither. I went to school in Little Italy, and you were either black, Mexican, maybe Polish, or Italian. If you were white, you were Polish or Italian,
yeah.
And I was neither. So I think, I mean, I don't use this term lightly. I mean, I was a minority a lot of my childhood growing up, and I think that that was a very valuable lesson, and a very, it informs a lot of the way I see the world today, I think.
How so, do you think?
Well, in the simplest sense, don't be a jackass.
I mean, you didn't get along with like the Polish kids or Italian kids. The other, like,
no, I mean, I was definitely bullied a lot as a kid. Mm-hmm. I was definitely made fun of. I didn't have a whole lot of friends at school. Most of my friends, I didn't have any friends that lived near me. I mean, actually, most of my childhood friends lived like out by like haunted trails, like 79th and Harlem and shit like that.
And how did you this is elementary school friends?
Or? Elementary school, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the other half were like kids I met through soccer, playing AYSO.
Oh, right. So you're a good soccer player.
I was.
Yeah. So you made friends that your teammates and stuff. You had.
Well, what was funny, and then that carried into high school because I was still sort of, I don't think I really fit in, but I was good at soccer. Uh-huh. So it was like this weird dynamic of like I hung out with the like metal kids, but then like people would talk shit about me, and then I would like school them on the soccer field, and then it was like, all right,
right, so what are we gonna say now?
Kinda.
I wasn't. No, not at. I don't think so at all. But you know what it's like in CPS. I mean, you know, I don't really think those stereotypical like American Pie
don't play the same way.
Stereotypes play the same way. Plus, I mean, Peyton was such a small school. I mean, it was like 800 kids in the whole school, so it was like kind of you all melted together whether or not you liked it or not. You know?
So, I really want to talk about the visual space and what you were seeing in the streets and in other spaces that was kind of motivating you to continue your visual practice. If you were doing that from 5 through elementary school, through high school, were you, you know, at what point did you begin to see, you know, and take that aspect of your life seriously?
I mean, the easy synopsis would be,
we got time. You can give us.
No, that's all good. Okay. It's just like, there were a few chapters in my life, and it's funny because I think about it sometimes. My earliest memory of graffiti is basically like somebody tagging my parents' building or the garage and my dad just being pissed off and like having to clean it. But I never really it probably sounds naive, but I never really realized that it was like an illegal act, you know? And then in elementary school, I remember, you know, somebody's older brother was doing graffiti and, like, you know, we were all younger and thought it was cool. And I think my first tag name ever was a South Park character. Like, we all, that ties back to what I was talking about earlier, because everybody chose a South Park character as their tag name, and I had to be Pip because I was the white boy. I totally forgot about that until just now.
Well, I can't even think of which one Pip is.
The little British kid that everybody makes fun of.
Yeah, the one I literally think about the least.
Yeah, and that you're was even funny butters? Too because they're all white and you're they're just like, ah, you're the, yeah, you're the you're fucking
right. The British white kid.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, anyways. He is kind of like a. Oh, never mind.
I don't know South Park, so like that. So.
But, you know, what was funny was, you know, even at my adolescence, obviously, you know, the neighborhood was changing, but it was still affordable to a lot of college students and art students. And obviously there was a great DIY art scene in Wicker.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would see these dudes like Sonny and Preston and Night Moves and Jimmy Carter was one of my favorites. And like these dudes, you know, they were doing graffiti, but there was no, it was completely different than the New York Wild Style, or like any of the, you know, when you think of graffiti, the more traditional things. These dudes were totally elementary. They were just out there with a can or a marker or oil stick, whatever, and just like, this is my handwriting. Fucking right. Preston.
Crude letters.
Totally elementary, like no quote-unquote style.
Yeah.
And that, even at like 13 years old, that hit me so hard. And I was just like, oh, this is awesome. And also at that time, you know, I did a, we had a family vacation to Europe, and I got to see, you know, I was like seeing Shepherd Fairey stuff in Paris and like, and Banksy stuff, and like just starting to really understand that like an image could be a force just as much as like your name.
Language, yeah.
And those two just punched me, and it was like, boom. And then, and obviously, you know, because of the spray paint ban, spray paint's illegal in the city of Chicago, I was just doing markers. And then I had always kind of heard about wheat paste. And it sounds silly now in this day of internet, but like, I like tried to Google a recipe for wheat paste, and I literally couldn't find one.
Mm. Yeah.
And I was like,
but this is when you're 13, 14.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah.
And I don't know. I just like, I was like, I know that this is possible. I just don't know how to do it. And then, I lived in Brazil for a while, and I figured it out in Brazil.
How old were you then?
Yeah.
Well, I lived in Brazil on two occasions. The first time was 18. And then the second time, I think I was 21 or something.
Okay.
21. But that was when I really, like, dialed in on it. And then...
when you figured out how to wheat paste.
Yeah, I mean, I had... when I was... yeah, I mean, I guess it was the first trip when I was 18. I did my first wheat paste that I can remember ever doing in São Paulo.
Is it really that prevalent there?
No.
Oh, okay. Some people you knew were doing it, or?
No, I was just there. And I don't know what happened, but one day I just was like, I'm going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was living in a neighborhood in São Paulo called Pompeia, and I just like left my family's house, and it was like, I don't know, it must have been like 7 o'clock or something. And I was just like, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't care, but like, I'm going to go do this.
Were you on vacation again, or you were?
No, I was at the,
like,
I was
study abroad there. Or something, oh. Or?
Sort of self-imposed study abroad.
Oh, okay.
Nice.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to study this wheat paste.
My,
in Brazil.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that was.
Sounds like a good program.
Yeah, I know.
That's why I was.
A good education.
Yeah, my dad lived in Brazil for a few years, so I'm not Brazilian, but I have a lot of ties to Brazil, and I love that country and São Paulo particularly so much.
Nice.
It's given me a lot of gifts.
So that clicked for you then, when you made the wheat paste, you put it up, and what was it about that form where you were like, shit, what was the breakthrough?
I don't know. I think I like the A to B to C of it all. I'll admit, it's a little different now, but at that time, especially in Chicago, because of the spray paint ban, I think a lot of artists that were doing or that had aspirations to do this sort of work went to wheat paste. And so I think Chicago probably has a bigger, well, at least it did, have a bigger wheat paste scene at that time than other cities, you know, than the Bay or than New York, because, you know, it's just like
go to
Home Depot and cop a few cans.
Right.
It was an out of necessity type thing. And I think, I don't know. I mean, I enjoyed, you know, everybody had their sort of, like, secret weapon, you know, like, in terms of making the glue. Like, I'm not going to divulge any secrets, but, like, everybody, you know, has their, like, yo, if you add this, you're good.
And so, also their own, I'm sorry, also their own ways to deploy it too, right? I mean, people had various strategies I've heard and seen a little bit about.
Yeah, and you know, like, I mean, every person has their, like, yo, I only go at this time.
Right.
Or, like, I only, you know,
I wear these civilian clothes in a particular bag. Or,
yeah, like I only go on Thursdays. Like da da da, and like, and that was sort of funny to me too because I was when I first started, I guess, really taking it seriously. I was in kind of a bad place, and I literally, I think I went almost every night for like 3 years. I went out, and it was like
shit
in Brazil.
No,
or in
no,
Chicago.
Here.
Oh, okay.
Here.
I was
once,
like, yeah. Damn,
once
out here.
Really been, yeah.
Once I got back.
And right.
What was your process of like, because now you can print wheat paste on computer, right?
Well, I mean, you could do that then, too.
It's oh, just, you could?
I mean, it's just paper.
Oh, okay, okay.
All my stuff is hand done. I've never,
right.
With one exception, I've never, like, digitally printed stuff. But that's also like, I suppose for other people that's part of the advantage. I mean, even like look at Shepard Fairey. I mean, that's
yeah.
That was part of his shtick is just making the same thing over and over and over
right.
And over. And all you got to do is go to Kinko's.
Right.
Yeah.
So that that time though, your 3 year run, you're back from Brazil. It's after that, obviously.
Yeah.
That's serious work. That's a lot of time out in the street. I imagine that might be a part of the moment where your parents or you know there was maybe a disagreement about the ways you were getting your work up or out there.
Yeah, I mean there was some not happy moments.
Right.
I mean it was a pretty ironic you know when you're on the cover of the Reader everything's great but when you're getting picked up in jail everything's not so great.
Right. So the Reader comes later. So as you're getting to these points yeah. of celebration and almost some acceptance, you also are putting in that work. So on the first of all, what was the thrill for you or what is the thrill for you of going out and hitting the streets like that?
You know, it's funny. I think a lot of the people that do it are in for the thrill. I don't really think I'm in for the thrill. Like I'm not. It's not like a ha-ha, you know. I don't ever, like, go home at the end of the night and I'm like, ha-ha, you pulled it off. Eat that, coppers, you know. Like, it's not some, like, Dillinger-esque thing or something. I guess the best thing I can say is that I think, and again, it goes back to my childhood, I think the street is public space, or at least it's supposed to be. And we live continually in a society where there's not public space. And you know, I think that, like, the kids playing buckets, the dude preaching the Bible, graffiti writers, the kids, you know, selling Hershey's for basketball jersey money... I mean, there's a very interesting audacity and genius in using the street to express an idea. And I think that the street should be a place to express ideas.
Yeah. And this is you're describing the culture of the public, and there is a increased sense of the reduction of that space, which I think is terrifying.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I said it in the book that is about to come out. It's, you know, they say if you're at a museum, the average person looks at a painting for 7 seconds. The average person on the street will listen to a person with an opinion for even less. Like, so I think that was what really attracted me. I think I just saw the street as this really pure way to get an idea out to as many people that are willing to hear it.
Well, and what is the it? Like, what are you trying in that time? And we could talk about the development of the language, the message, the characters. But yeah, what is if you could maybe just describe even in that period some of what you were putting out into the street.
I don't know what initially drew me other than, you know, I was a kid that grew up in a big city and I was just always, you know, I lived a lot of life in the street. You know, I lived a lot of life interacting with other people, whether it's neighbors or the, you know, the drunks or the druggies or whatever. And I definitely, obviously, developed a huge affinity for Chicago. And I wanted to do something that, you know, pays tribute to those people and that time in the neighborhood. I mean, you know, the guys that never really got a fair shot, the union dudes, and union women, and just a very hardworking Chicago mentality, that I guess still fascinates me.
And it's still here. I think that there is a challenge to...
It is, for sure.
...pushing those people away, it seems, increasingly. You know, that the economy shifting the way it has and seems to continually threaten the sanctity of, you know, a working person's ability to remain in the city.
Yeah, I mean, I think quite often of what Nelson Algren would think of Division Street today.
Could you imagine? Yeah.
And, you know, or Royko or Turkle, even Ebert. I mean, I was at the OG Billy Goat before I came here.
Yeah.
On Laura Wacker.
Nice. Did you see Rick Hogan there? He's a great, great Chicago journalist. One of the last of that of that run. One of Studs' mentees.
Oh, awesome.
He's there a lot.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I love sitting there and just thinking. There's a great Royko story about I don't know, who knows if it's true or not, but the synopsis was like a young couple has an argument and the girl runs off and the guy's like, that's it. I can't live without her. If she's going to leave me, I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to jump in the river. And old man at the end of the bar says, kid, don't do it. Don't kill yourself. And he says, no, without her, I can't live. And he says, no, I don't care if you kill yourself. Just don't jump in the river because I run one of those tour boats and I'm going to have to, you know, scoop you out. You're gonna cause a big delay. It's gonna be a big fuss. Just go jump in the lake.
Yeah.
And then someone on the other end of the bar goes, don't tell him to jump in the lake. I'm a smelt fisherman. Like, I'm gonna have to scoop him out. You know, it's gonna cause, you know, 3 weeks ago we had a floater. We just shoved him off so we could buoy out. And by the end of it, the kid's so, like, just perturbed. He's just like, I'm never coming back here again.
Those jobs even are very like Chicago sounding.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jobs.
Oh, yeah. Still.
Jebs.
So, all right. So, when did you start to think about a space that wasn't the street, or were you always thinking about the studio, the gallery?
I never really was. To be honest, when I was, so like I said, I studied photography in college, and I wanted to be an editorial photographer.
That's an interesting departure.
And
yeah.
You weren't painting?
I was like sort of painting. I mean, I definitely was like moving further away from photography. I was doing a lot of like weird collage painting, mixed media type stuff. And I had an amazing, amazing professor.
This at what school again? We didn't.
I was at Columbia.
Okay, and you graduated.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Wow.
Kudos.
We don't get a lot of graduates from Columbia on the show.
Stayed the course.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
who was your professor?
So I had this amazing professor named Elizabeth Ernst, and she was kind of a mentor for a lot of those years. And I was doing this crazy project. I was like drawing on, I was making these super elaborate studio scenes, and drawing on studio sweeps and like lighting in front and behind, and I was shooting Polaroid, like Type 55, 4x5, large format, and well, two things happened. I was going to graduate, and I wasn't going to have access to the studio anymore, and Polaroid went bankrupt. So it was suddenly like, you don't have any more resources.
And yeah, I had, your medium no longer exists.
Exactly, yeah. And I had this great teacher, and she was like, you know, you're doing all this stuff, but are you doing it because that's what you want to do, or are you doing it because you don't know how to paint? And I obviously had painted as a child a lot and had drawn a lot, and some other stuff happened, and I just sort of suddenly found myself going full circle back to what I was doing as a child. And this was before the second Brazil pilgrimage. I just sort of found myself back, and like, and if I'm being honest, like sort of really angry and graffiti just seemed to be the only thing that made sense. I'd played team sports my entire life, and I had always sort of felt like no one cared as much as me, and then all of a sudden I found this thing, and it's like, the only thing in your way is you, and maybe the police.
Right, yeah. Well, there is a lot of the writers that I've talked with, it seems like an athletic discipline almost that they will apply to the art. That the rigor, the planning, the motivation to get out is also like, well, I got to get up and get this workout in, or I got to, you know, there seems to be, you know, some sort of, and not that writers are athletes per se. Although,
but it's a team sport. Sort of, you know, well, you got crews and stuff, right?
You
well,
do, but
yeah.
But also, people.
But also, like, I was never a part of that in that sense. I mean, I was actually sort of like, I don't think a lot of people liked me for a long time, even in that world. But I agree with you in that sense. And actually, Barry McGee famously said, and I totally agree, some of my favorite graffiti to look at is unfinished pieces, because you see everything. I mean, you see, okay, he hopped up that drain pipe, scurried across that, jumped on this roof, and like, and then there's this big question mark, like, what happened? Because, like, you know, I've been in that place. Like, I know you're going to do anything to fucking finish this piece, but you didn't finish it.
Right.
So, like, what? Like,
yeah,
what
it's like a skeleton sometimes, which is
I just
really,
yeah, I love, you know, you see this narrative on the street every day,
and wheat pasting I know folks who go out in pairs sometimes, but wheat pasting is also sometimes, I think, more of a solitary engagement as opposed to sometimes graffiti where it is crew based.
Yeah.
You have a lookout, you have apprentices, you have you know.
Well, I mean, I think I only became more familiar with weed pacing like in the last 4 or 5 years. But to me, it's like more commercialized, I guess, now. I mean, you know, like I see ads or I see like, you know.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
And that's my like entrance into it. So
Yeah. Even
in that way, it doesn't seem like.
Yeah, they've stayed the commodifying
same.
Like both the practices of weed paste.
Like, yeah.
Weed paste folks and street artists and graffiti writers, right? It's like companies will also wrap a train. Like they, you know, like writers did top to bottoms,
right?
And yeah, I think like ad folks have also taken some of what you and some of your peers have done and used it to, you know, put like advertise widely for a music festival.
Yeah, and
like
it's a double-edged sword because on the one hand, you know, like I just got into it last summer with some, you know, viral marketing campaign about what was it? It was like some veggie burger bullshit. I don't know.
Impossible Burger.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Damn.
That was it. I got into it hardcore.
How? Because what they? Because
they went over me, and then I went over them.
Damn!
I went over them hard. Hell yeah! It was like,
that's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Battle the corporation.
I have I have a weird thing with veganism. Like, I just.
You don't believe in it, or what's going on?
Also,
Anthony Bourdain famously called vegans the Hezbollah of the culinary world, and like,
damn.
And I check this out. I Googled this a few years ago because I was joking with a friend that there must be a non-for-profit in the world that sends food to Africa, but only vegan food. There are two. And like, I don't know. I mean, this sort of is a big part of, I think, my work, because I think ideas are powerful and passion is a virtue. But people with passion and people with ideas, you know, it can be skewed into ideology. And, you know, to me, I mean, I have so many vegan friends, and like, and I have no problem with it. Like, in terms of like, to me, veganism is about personal choice, about individual assertion of like what is going into my body, how I'm affecting my ecosystem, my, you know, my marketplace, yada, you know. When you start pushing those ideas on other people, then it's become slightly more problematic. And
yeah, like anything, you know.
Like anything, yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean,
like, I insist that you wear green. That's it. Please just wear green.
Yeah. I mean,
why? Because I like green.
Yeah. So, sorry, I guess I lost my.
No, that's okay. Well,
Impossible Burgers do really taste like meat. Just yeah, gonna say
they are kind of baggy.
Okay, but
to
even
be honest,
that's
they're
a ridiculous notion. Actually, I was talking to a vegan friend of mine about this, because the whole thing with the Impossible Burger is that it bleeds.
Yeah, yeah.
That's bullshit. And any right-minded vegan person should be offended by that shit.
Well, I'm vegetarian, and I just think it's weird that if you're vegetarian, you don't want to eat that. So, like, why are you imitating that?
Well, that's
so fair. I got one just to see, and it tastes like beef, and I was like, this is actually, like, tastes too close to
it. I mean, I'm not saying you need some, like, chick apostrophe N, you know, frozen thing. Like, I mean, I, frankly, these days, I probably eat more vegetables than I eat meat. I mean, I have a salad pretty much every day. But
you got to stay healthy to be out in the streets.
I just think, you know, I'm trying.
Yeah.
But I do love kale.
Do you massage your kale, though?
I don't know if I massage my kale. I don't think I do.
That's pretty intimate. We don't want to.
Yeah, you know, yeah. What a man does with his kale in the comfort of his own home.
I guess I don't want to know that.
Listen.
But anyways, but yeah, I mean, I just think that's hilarious. Is like, you know, your whole problem, you know, isn't it like meat is murder and like blood is inherently linked with murder?
But I think it's also like,
but you know, if a beet fucking spew some
beef
juice
blood
out
is
of it.
Okay. Yeah,
but I think it's more of a mockery. I think it's more of like a, if you eat a lot of meat and you like burgers and you have like alternatives, so you don't get heart disease and die. You know?
Yeah.
Maybe.
We're probably going to get heart disease regardless of how much meat we eat.
I mean,
well, y'all,
guys,
I mean,
I'm not a nutritionist.
Look, I'll say that. I mean, on this issue, like, if I could live in Wicker Park and own livestock and like ethically own livestock, I would, and I would raise those things, and they would have the happiest lives ever, and when the time came, I would put a bullet in their head myself.
That, which is what, when I lived in Wicker Park in the 90s, and my neighbor had chickens
farming
in the back. Yeah, he had chickens in the back, and when he wouldn't put a bullet, he would just, like, spots, twist their neck, and that'd be, you know, that'd be dinner. So, if we can step away from veganism. Yeah.
A little off topic.
One of my favorite gallery shows that I've seen ever was what you did in the closing hardware store that was on Halsted Lake.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how long ago this was.
That would have been about 4 years ago now.
Okay.
Maybe five.
But that, because that was, it was, not only was it brilliant in terms of the work that was in the space, but it was also you engaged this space, and then the space was no longer after, right? I mean, I think you had probably one of the last things to ever be in that space, and then they tore it down.
Yeah, the show was open for 2 weeks, and then they tore it down. The show opened, I think, like August 16th or something, and then they tore the building down on August 30th.
But that foray into the gallery world, when did you begin to make those steps?
I mean, I think when I started, I never really had any intention of doing gallery work or that I would sell my work. I just wanted to do stuff in the street. When the gallery stuff started happening, I did a few projects previous to that. I really was interested in A, in temporary things, B, in taking the street energy and molding it in a different way that would, you know, affect the gallery. I didn't want to just, like, you know, do what I was doing in the street inside and, like, call it a day. And then I don't know, you know, even as a kid, because of my parents, we went to museums all the time, but I was never really interested. And I was never really interested in the white wall gallery, you know, here's eight things that I made in the last year, call it a day. I was really interested in immersive things. Actually, it was totally ironic. I saw that building and I was planning on putting a wheat paste on it. And then by total chance, this guy bought a painting from me, and then he was like, I want you to see something. And he was like, I just bought this property. Do you want to paint this building? And I was like, yeah. And then he was like, okay, cool. And then he was like, you can keep your paint in here. And that was the hardware store. And then I mean, I don't know if I'll ever fall in love harder again in my life than when I walked into that room.
Right.
I mean, it was absolutely amazing. And, you know, I mean, that room was a complete time capsule.
Yeah.
I mean, that guy, you know, there's stories. I had a friend that famously told me, is like, yeah, I'd go in there on a Tuesday and ask, like, hey, I need some keys made. And he'd be like, yeah, we're not doing keys today. Come back on Thursday. I mean, we found asbestos for sale.
What?
Wow. Like packaged, you know, like,
wow.
Home Dude's inventory hadn't changed in 50 years.
Right.
I didn't even know that at a time that was sold.
Yeah. Yeah. It was an insulation.
I mean, I probably lost a year of my life.
Right.
Being in there, but I'll take it.
Yeah. It was kind of like a hardware store, right? Those are, yeah.
And it was just such a...
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, and I'm really proud of that project because it was, I think, a summary of a lot of the things that I want to say and that I really care about. And yeah. It was just so like, this is Chicago. This is who we are. This is what we're about. And it's leaving. So right. If you care about it, support it. Like,
right.
You know, I mean, I'm guilty of it too, but it's like, yo, go to Imperial Hardware. Don't go to Home Depot. You know, like, go to Bari. Don't go to Jimmy John's. Like,
yeah. And that show, I mean, your work in general, I think, wrestles with a lot of that in a romantic, nostalgic, humorous way. But in a way that also kind of, I think, pushes the readership to think more critically about some of these things.
Because it's not outwardly any of those things, though. I feel like you have to study it in order to grasp any of those, I guess, nuances.
Yeah, yeah. After that, I feel like you started to bubble. I felt like you started to get a lot more looks, some press.
Right, and I read an article where it said nobody knew what you looked like. And obviously don't know your real name. So, but that is not the case anymore.
You know, I still try to keep down low. I mean, obviously, there was a ridiculous article that compared me to Banksy.
Yeah, that's the one I read.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, damn, you know, okay.
You can't write your own headlines.
Right. How did you feel about that comparison, though?
I mean, flattered, but obviously not really accurate.
I mean, this makes you sound lit, though, you know? I was like, okay. I mean, I already knew, you know.
And now for your first commercial break, we're going to the corner store with Dom Fred. He's the Banksy of Chicago, folks. Come on down. Two for one Fritos.
That's good. That's good.
Two for one RX bars.
I could have been a voice actor.
No, absolutely. Look, I mean, it's never too late.
You're right.
And pivot.
And then you also, of course, you had, I mean, recently you had work in the Netflix series Easy.
Yeah.
You aren't in it, your work is, or do you make an appearance?
No, I'm in it.
Right. Okay. So how was that one of your kind of coming?
Okay, but what was the role, though? I've seen it, and I just, like, can't recall, I guess.
I played myself.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Because the guys who are doing the brewery are using your art to...
Yeah, I remember that.
And so was that a difficult decision for you to make, just in terms of being visible under your...
Yeah, and on the camera. That's, like, 0 to 100.
It was... Yeah, it was a hard choice. What was, you know, in another life, I did a lot of acting in high school. I did about 6 years of improv also.
Oh, wow.
And it was always, actually, when I started school, college, I was a double major, photography and writing, and I had always probably unsurprisingly had aspirations of doing comedy writing. So, by total happenstance, this thing, came out of nowhere, and Joe asked me to be a part of this project, and Joe's amazing, and, he told me a little bit about what he was thinking, and it was, ironically, very similar to things that were actually happening in my real life already.
Right, you just did a brewer or some beer in Pittsburgh or something like that, right?
Yeah, I just painted a mural for a brewery and did a collaboration beer. So,
right.
I mean, and just through other projects, I've sort of been involved in that world. So it just kind of, it made sense. And his entire crew is like people I went to college with. I mean, his cinematographer was one of my best friend's roommates. So it just... kind of made sense, and I don't know, I was just like, yeah, this will be fun.
Yeah. Has that compromised your ability to practice?
No. Again, I guess what I love most about this is it's a individual sport. End of the day, it's still the only person in my way is me.
Yeah. And the fuzz.
I mean, there's been some instances that I probably would rather not deal with in terms of, like, just going about my day-to-day life.
People recognize you?
Yeah.
That must be weird.
Yeah.
Especially if you're trying to be anonymous.
Yeah, and, right? Like, you're not super photographed and stuff, I guess, so.
Yeah, I mean, I still definitely keep that up. I mean, what I have found and what I take solace in and I think is funny is my character is a lot more concerned with anonymity than I am. Mm. I look at it all as levels.
Yeah. So this year, so you have the book coming out. Can you tell us a little more about the book or title or when we can expect it? Or
I don't have a solid release date yet, but it will hopefully be this year. It's called Life Thus Far, and it's basically just my first retrospective predominantly focusing on street work. I've done two books previous to this, but they were both very project-oriented. This one is a bit more like, this is just what I've been doing.
Right.
And, paired with poems, or...?
So it's paired with a lot of anecdotes. A lot of it is centered around the traveling I've done. A lot of people have contributed, you know, just little stories about, you know, what happened one night in Italy when we were trying to put up a piece, or, you know, getting almost arrested in New York, or just like a weird night in Miami.
I've seen you in Miami.
A lot of weird Miami stuff.
Sure.
Yeah, we actually, me and Cyrus Fountain pulled a guy out of the ocean in Miami. He was, I still don't really understand what the hell happened to him, but.
He was the kid at the bar who was talking about killing himself.
Yeah, we were walking to Scope, one of the art fairs. It was like 10 a.m. on a, who knows, Tuesday or Wednesday or something. And we see this guy face down in the water, and he looks like he's snorkeling, except he doesn't have a snorkel. And he's only in, like, probably about 2-3 feet of water. And we're just like, what's this guy doing? And we run in, and we're like, hey, buddy. And we, like, pull him up, and he's unconscious. And then we're just like, oh, my
wow.
God.
Damn.
So we pull him out, and none of us know CPR. So we're just, like, just hitting him, just like, hey, 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 hey. And he just goes... and just spits up all this water and is just like, I can't feel my legs, I can't feel my legs, I can't feel my legs. And, you know, ambulance comes and everything. They take him to the hospital. Turns out he had somehow, like, fractured a vertebrae and was, like, paralyzed. And he was, like, face down in the water holding his breath, like, I'm going to die when we pulled him out. And apparently... Cyrus looked this up, but there's some medical center in Miami that specializes in, like, paralyzation. And so I guess what they do, they figured out basically the first thing they do when you're admitted is they put you on ice. And they found, I don't know all the medical stuff behind it, but they found that by essentially freezing you, it stops the paralysis. It's the only place in the world does this. So, like, literally, this guy, he's from New York. If he had gotten hurt in New York, he's in a wheelchair right now. But it happened in Miami, and they took him to this place.
Oh, he wasn't, like, there for that, though?
He was there for the art fair.
Oh, for the art fair. Okay. I thought maybe he was there for, like, the medical center.
So, wait, you kept in touch with this dude? Or are you...
So, I've never met this guy again.
Right.
I never really met him. I just pulled him out of the water.
I just saved his life.
Right.
But no, Cyrus lived in New York for a long time. So, like, 2 years later, he went and, like, had dinner with him and his wife and, like, kid. And they were, like, he can walk. Like,
what?
Because of this center. So, yeah, it's crazy.
Yo, okay.
That was a hard moment. I mean, Miami is so ridiculous. And then all the Art Basel shit... It's so ridiculous, and it's just like, it was such a mind fuck, and it just put everything in perspective, like, so much. Like, imagine, like, you know, you just, I mean, I'm not even saying that, but you pull a man out of the ocean, and then 15 minutes later, you're drinking, like, a free margarita looking at a $20,000 painting. Like, I mean, if that doesn't put your life in perspective in terms of, like, what matters.
Right.
Like...
Weird juxtaposition of shit.
So where
to be clear, the $20,000 painting is what matters in this, in this situation.
Also, kidding. My paintings are $20,000. So
also, just raise my prices right now. Come on down to the corner store.
Do we get free margaritas though? Stuck on that.
Yeah, we need a aspirational tequila sponsor.
And I hear they're opening a big star in WGN Studios.
Yo, where outside of the streets, where can folks in Chicago see your work coming up?
Safe bet's going to be the streets.
Okay, get out in the streets.
There'll be some stuff coming up, but I.
Can't talk about it.
Yeah, there's no dates yet.
So. Got you. Where can folks find you on social media, though?
The social medias will be the Instagrams. You can search Hottie for Naughty 420 XXX 666.
I think diet. That's too many letters for Instagram handle.
No, he's got a deal. He's got a deal.
And they just expanded. It's like the World Cup's going from 32 teams to 48.
Right. Now Twitter Twitter got longer in terms of the characters.
Did they? They went past 140? I don't use Twitter.
Yeah, 180. 280.
280, yep.
180.
I don't know.
Kevin.
Okay. Don't fret. Thank you, ma'am.
Thanks
for being here. Really, really appreciate you.
No, thanks, man.
Yeah, no. I, yeah.
Oh, you know, hey, I wanted to tell you this. Oh. And I wanted to talk about it. I totally forgot about it. So I won a couple Young Author Awards when I was in CPS.
Ah, for books you wrote for them?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. I saw, you know, I mean, I know we don't know each other very well, but I knew that you were involved.
And yeah.
I was just laughing about
it. No, that's really funny.
I was like, oh yeah, I did that.
Yeah, yeah. Did you ever? Because I know Peyton. We, you know, we have a long-standing poetry program there. I don't know if you ever competed or got down with any of that stuff.
I don't think I was involved in that. I did, as I mentioned, I was when I started at Columbia. I was a fiction writing major, so I was involved with a few of their publications.
Yeah.
But I don't think I did anything at Peyton. And actually, I think most of the Young Author stuff was from when I was in
elementary
school.
Yeah, no doubt.
But
yeah, that's funny though.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. I really enjoyed talking with you, and you know, hope to continue to do it.
Yeah,
Yeah, and definitely following the work, and love seeing. Like, I feel like it's a real special day when you get to see your work in the streets. So thank you for making that so for so many of us.
And thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate you. Yo, we want to thank DJ Exist for the beat.
Langston Olsen for the art.
Big ups, Todd Manley at WGN Radio.
And Max and Dami, the Corner Store interns.
Salutes to our super producer, DJ Cash Era.
You can keep in tune with the Corner Store at @_pod on Instagram, Twitter, and SoundCloud.
Also, you can stream and download the Corner Store wherever you listen to podcasts.
And please rate and subscribe and comment on iTunes.
Please, y'all, consider giving us those 5 stars.
Thank you for listening.
We're going to see you next week.